And the story of Women Who Kill changes. So we've spoken about the idea of the witch. Then when we move into the 18th century, we start to see the emergence of a kind of tragic heroine who kills because, and 18th and 19th centuries, they kill because they've been rejected or neglected by men. So they'll kill their own child, or they'll kill themselves, or they'll kill a lover because that lover has been cruel to them. So it's taking away agency from a woman. Then we start having laws that come into place, the insanity laws in England. And these insanity laws are really important when it comes to the convictions of women. Women are much more likely to be found not guilty by reason of insanity than men are, because again, we're taking away that agency. We do not want to acknowledge the fact that women can kill.
This is The Way Podcast.
The militias needed to have a heads up that I was coming.
I personally think that, like in chess.
So that's how deep the addiction goes.
I've been incarcerated most of my life.
Having a conversation with
Bill. They've been given no option, either join or die.
Snipers, and it was a military.
J. Cole came and hung out most of the choir session. I'm standing at the studio glass looking out into the studio.
If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.
This is Bill with The Way Podcast on FM 91.7, WHUS Doors at the top of the hour. Also on FM 90.3, WRIU, South Kingston at the top of the hour. Today, I'll be speaking with Rebecca Riddle about her book 1666 and the history of female killers and how they were perceived. Don't forget to give a 5-star rating, like, share the show. Every little bit helps. You can find information at podcasttheway.com. Follow on Instagram or Twitter at Podcast The Way, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Radio People. Just follow there. What made you want to write this book, 1666, in the first place?
Gosh, that's a good question. I've always been, I say always, since I was a teenager, I was really fascinated by a period in British history that's known as the Restoration. So that's a period from around 1660, depending on how you're looking at it, to roughly around 1700. But I particularly liked everything that was going on during the reign of Charles II, because it seemed quite exciting, quite fun. There's also lots of trauma. And I always thought, well, it would be great to write a book about that, but how to do it, what's already out there, you know what it's like. You have to kind of measure the market and think about how your project would have a USP. You know, what is
then
that
you have to submit
point?
It. Then you have to submit to a publication and they're like, oh, well, what makes it different? You got to get that approval process.
Yeah, exactly. But then I thought, well, the Great Fire is interesting. The anniversary of the Great Fire of London, the 350th anniversary, was coming up. So I started writing it in 2015. The anniversary was in 2016. But doing research into it a bit more, I thought, well, actually, there's a story to tell here about the Great Plague as well, which happened the year before, but spilled into 1666 as well. And what I didn't anticipate was becoming so interested in naval warfare, which I'd never shown an interest in previously. But there was a huge war between the English and the Dutch that took place from 1665 to 1667. And I thought, well, let's combine these three things, pitch it as one book and see if I can do the story of a year. And thankfully, somebody thought, yes, we'll take that on. We'll commission it. So that's kind of how it happened.
Awesome. And is that like the, I know England historically was known for having a great naval fleet. Was this the beginning of it, or were they already established at that point in time?
Excuse me, I'm just going to cough. sorry.
Let me put my mask on.
I guess you could say this was the start, but it was a really rough start. There was geographically, England, Britain, and Ireland are positioned in an ideal space to become prominent in seafare. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to happen. And during the 17th century, there was a slow process to build up the naval side of the military. Most of that was as a result of wars with the Dutch. and the Dutch had an amazing navy as well. So they were kind of growing in tandem with the Dutch and competing. And the fact that the wars were local, as in just across the sea, meant that they were kind of looking at each other's ships and thinking, oh, well, what have they got compared to what we've got? And because of that competition, ships and warfare was improving. I mean, improving is not really a word you want to say when it comes to warfare, but in terms of
one
technologies
thing wars
and stuff.
Always good for is innovation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess you could say this was the beginning. It was certainly the beginning of all of the baggage that would go with naval warfare as well, and the navy, i.e. empire, colonialism, and all the rest of that awful stuff.
Gotcha. And this was the second. So what happened? Like, what caused the first one, and then what led into the second? Yeah.
Yeah. So there were three. Actually, there were four Anglo-Dutch wars altogether, but the fourth one was in the 18th century, so we don't need to concern ourselves with that. But they were all about commerce. They were all about trade. They were all about trading posts, and they were about rivalry and resentment and jealousy between the two nations. England thought that it should have what the Dutch had. The Dutch thought that it should have what England had. So they were competing for trading posts along the West African coast, which were becoming available as the Portuguese and the Spanish empires were in decline. Now, these trading posts, we know now to history that they would become integral in the transatlantic slave trade. And that is what they were going for. But they were also under the illusion that they'd be able to access gold at these sites as well. So there's wars going on that side of the Atlantic and the other side of the Atlantic as well, in islands and mainland, well, the main islands of the Americas.
Gotcha. And I remember, well, not too long ago, a minute ago, you said you didn't expect to get interested in the naval ships, the Navy ships. What was so interesting about it? Like, what captured you?
It's exciting just to read the first-hand accounts of the letters that were going back and forth from people on board the ships, and they were being ferried to the coast and then also transported on horseback by messengers to London to give them updates as the battles were going on. And you read these letters and they're so detailed and they're so full of feeling and emotion and facts and things. It's hard not to become engaged in all of that. And also, I'm not a nationalistic Brit. I'm not a kind of, I wouldn't call myself a patriot in any way whatsoever. So I found it quite funny that the country I live in has always prided itself on having this amazing historical navy, and it was kind of a comedy of errors. These battles, and I found that quite amusing, to be honest.
Oh, they really give off this image of being so elite, top tier, but they actually were clumsy in the background.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that got me interested. Just the human side of things, the human stories.
Were there any stories that stood out to you, like that really show clumsiness?
So there was a kind of a raft of young noblemen who were in their teens, some possibly in their early 20s, and they saw these wars as a way to just have an adventure. And you see letters where people are saying, I'm going to go to battle and I'm going to kill Michael de Ruyter, who was the big leader of the Dutch Navy. And you're just thinking, you're like 17 years old, this, you know, you're not going to be killing this veteran Navy commander. And so I thought that was quite funny. And then there's a story about the Earl of Rochester, who's a notorious poet from the 17th century. He wrote lots of dirty poetry. But before he did that, he went to war. And he said that during one of the missions to Bergen in Norway, that he was going there to find treasure, basically, from the ships that they would capture. But then there's a story that he created this pact with his comrades that if one of them should die, then they'd come back to the others to prove that there was life after death. And one of them died, but he didn't come back. And apparently this is what set the Earl of Rochester on his kind of atheist trajectory. So I like those individual stories. But yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Too. Yeah, that gets in like that whole, especially during that time, everything was so religious too. So I bet it must have been a whole game changer just seeing like like, what would somebody interpret as a sign in that case, or what's not, you know?
Yeah, and there's an interesting story to tell about the birth of atheism as well. I don't think we could necessarily claim that people in the 17th century were atheists as we would understand atheists today, but they were definitely starting to go onto the path that would lead to that in the 18th century, the age that's been named the Enlightenment, but was anything but for lots of reasons.
The story about the teenagers, young kids getting excited to go off to war and, like, you know, well, kill the big enemy or whatnot, that still kind of carries today, I feel like, with, like, maybe it's dying down a little bit. Vietnam, I feel like, didn't have that as much, but there's still that image of advertisements you see on the TV of, come join the army, look, and it shows somebody doing some epic with drones going around, they got the gun, they're going in the trenches, or, like, well, modern day trenches, but you know what I'm saying? We still have that fondness towards war with some people.
I think so, and I also think that if you're a very young adult and you're not quite sure what you want to do, but you feel that you want to make a difference, the army is a really seductive way to do that. And I can see how lots of people would be seduced by the propaganda and wanting to go and fight, but also for an adventure. I mean, this historically, joining the army or the navy was a way to travel and to see places. And if you're from humble means, which most people were throughout history, then you're not really going to have any other options to do that. So I think the idea of adventure is something that still resonates too.
I feel like that part would work on me back in those olden days. But nowadays, I feel like it transformed where, at least in America, it's like, all right, we'll join the army and we'll give you like a free college education, or we'll give you a free, we'll pay you this like high salary, or we'll give you these benefits, health insurance, stuff like that. Like, that's like the modern version of traveling the world.
Yeah, it is. But also, we're much more savvy nowadays, I suppose. We know much more about the horrors of warfare. We know about, you know, it's not about goodies and baddies. It's about people on all sides. And, you know, you might fundamentally disagree with the views and opinions, but what you can't avoid when you're talking about warfare and battles and stuff is that there will be countless deaths. There will be, you know, civilian deaths. And maybe it's a good thing that we know that and are aware of that.
Yeah, especially with what's going on with Ukraine and Russia. A lot of attention on that, showing that. But back to the research, you said you were reading those papers. Were those the bills of mortality I saw you went through?
So the bills of mortality, yes, I went through them. They were a separate source, but they're really fascinating. So what they are basically a data set that was collected by women who were named searchers, and they would go into households to search the dead and find out the cause of death before people were buried. And these searchers would then feed back the numbers to the parish clerk, and they would compile a list and put them all together, and then it would be worked out over the City of London, across the City of London, how many people had died from particular things. So plague would be one thing, but there are lots of other causes of death that are quite interesting and unique to but interesting in terms of the 17th century. So people could die of teeth, for example. Lots of children died, and babies died in babies as they were being born. So they're fascinating documents because they really give you a glimpse of how plague was spreading during 1665 and 1666. And they were documents that were published every week and anyone could have access to. I think, although my figures might be wrong, I think you paid a penny for one of the bills of mortality. And then you would look and say you were living in one parish area. You would look at that and see how close it was to another parish that perhaps had like 10 plague deaths. And if it was going up and up and you could see it getting closer to where you lived, you might decide to leave the city, which lots of people did.
Yeah, you said, you mentioned teeth. Were some of those deaths, I remember hearing that the rich noble people back then ate a lot of sugar, their teeth would rot. So they'd take the teeth from like little kids and they try to like put them in their own mouth, like take their tooth out, put the new young tooth back in. It wouldn't really work, but like, did anybody die because of that?
I don't know if they died through that process, but they certainly died because of tooth infections, because of all the sugar. I mean, yeah, they certainly, sorry, they, yeah, they certainly died because of that. But yeah, the teeth, I haven't thought about teeth for a long while, but it's so gross, isn't it? So, and this isn't the subject of my book. It's not even the, it's not even something that I specialize in terms of history, historical periods, but during the Napoleonic Wars, they used to harvest teeth from the dead during battles, and they would turn them into dentures, which they'd sell in like London in like sophisticated dentist shops and things. And it's so gross when you think about it. I think, did Abraham Lincoln have a set of, he had false teeth, but I think he had teeth that were borrowed from dead people, as well as wooden ones as well.
I could be thinking completely different, but somebody, they had like a hole in the jaw, and I think it would whistle when they would breathe. Was that him?
Was that Abraham Lincoln? I don't know.
It would be too hard to search up. So for now,
your listeners need to Google and find and let you know.
Yeah, put an asterisk on that so people can't say, "Hey, he's spreading false information. He's one of those podcasters." No, I'm acknowledging it might not be too accurate. So yeah, like, two of the three themes were plague affecting the country and then the war. How did the plague and war overlap? Like, how did the plague affect the war? Who did it hurt one side more?
Yes, it hurt England more, much more. But they blame the Dutch as well, because the Dutch had had the plague the year before and it had spread across the channel through trade ships. And England just was crippled by plague. So many people were ill. Sailors, when they were discharged from service, they were catching plague, they were begging on the streets. It was absolutely terrible. But still, in terms of the country's finances, everything was being pushed into this war with the Dutch. There wasn't that much finance being put behind public health measures. They were quite rudimentary. I used to think they were rudimentary, but then we went through COVID, and actually isolating is probably the only thing that worked to start with before we had a vaccine. So yeah, there was a definite intersection between the two things.
So if all the money went towards the war effort, how did that affect the common folk back in like English cities or towns?
Well, they were taxed. There were taxes. As I said, there were people that were begging. Some people had a good plague. Plague didn't affect them. You know, they were living in villages or towns that didn't have the plague. So Cambridge was hit hard by plague, but Oxford managed to escape it. What Oxford didn't escape, though, was the royal court, which fled from London to Oxford and caused caused mayhem in Oxford, according to some of the professors that were stationed there. Although they were living there, I should say, they complained about the royal court. I don't want to swear in your podcast, but they complained about them. How can I phrase it? Leaving excrement, human excrement around different halls and things. Delightful.
Like January 6th?
kind of.
Yeah, people get political stuff, yada yada, but they actually were like rubbing the walls in D.C. with like human feces and piss and all that. Like, I don't know.
I don't know what happens to people. I mean, that's a big discussion. With a psychologist, I don't know. People just go crazy in crazy times.
I was reading this book called Hive Mind, and I reached out to have the girl who wrote that on the show. We were planning something, but then the time came and it didn't work out. But yeah, like it's a great read. It's just all about tribalism and how like you sort of lose your own identity in the crowd. You just become a part of it. Like you see it with bars and clubs, or you see it with like riots.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I guess it is human nature in a way, because we're conditioned to want to fit in, because that's how you survive. That, you know, if you are part of a group, you survive. If you're an outlier, you don't tend to. But it's, it's really fascinating to look at it in a kind of macro way.
I saw a comic yesterday, where it's like a 4-page comic. It shows the guy who did this experiment. He's like, "I'm going to split these people into group A and group B. And I'm going to see how they react." And like mid-sentence, he gets cut off because one guy in group B goes, "Yo, F group A over there. They're pieces of blank." Like, just like about human nature.
Well, it's like Stockholm syndrome, isn't it? It's that the ultimate, when you divide people up and give them roles, they change.
And one thing I want to bring it back a bit. One thing I wanted to ask too is going through those papers and like reading up the history, was there maybe like a translation hurdle or something? Because back then people spoke different than we do today. So was, how did the people back then speak? Or
yeah, I love that because I don't speak with received pronunciation. I don't have like a BBC accent. I might sound like I do to listeners across the Atlantic. I don't know. I don't know my voice well enough, but I definitely don't have a BBC accent. So I've always been fascinated by accents and the way people speak, and the fact that that received pronunciation came into being towards the end of the 18th century. And it isn't any early, you know, wasn't any earlier than that. So when you read contemporaneous plays and books and pamphlets, you can see some of the rhythm of people's dialect in there. So Shakespeare, for example, you can look at the words that he uses to rhyme with other words which don't rhyme today, and you think, well, actually, that means they must have spoke in a different way. So yes, I'm losing my train of thought. Yes, there are lots of different spellings as well. Spelling hasn't been established. So when you're looking at letters, you have to read in a kind of phonetic way, which is harder when you don't know the exact dialect that people are speaking. So that's slightly tricky. But what's good about the 17th century is that, in my personal view, it's the earliest time that we can go back to without putting in loads of effort into paleography. So I'm a bit lazy. I mean, I couldn't look at letters from the 16th century, for example. It would just be too hard. But the 17th century, you can start to read them with your own eye and not have to work out too much what certain scribbles mean and stuff.
Did you have to put in some like guesswork to fill in the blanks, or were there enough papers that you got a clear understanding of this happened here, this happened here, this?
No, I didn't put any guesswork in. I don't actually like it when history books do that. I don't like it when they're non-fiction. I don't like it when they say things like, we can imagine that this is what would have happened, or we can imagine that she was thinking this at that time. Well, no, you can't imagine that because you're not her. And this, you know, so I don't like that at all. So I try to knit scenes together with historical fact and historical sources. If I can't find the sources to set the scene, then I won't set that particular scene. I'll just tell that story in a different way. But the 17th century is really rich for source material. So incidental things like describing the weather. We've got lots of reports about weather because of the Navy, so because they were always checking the weather because they needed to know when their ships would be able to move on the water. So there's lots of sources to do that with. Particularly during the Restoration, we've got Samuel Pepys's diary. Who is this really interesting man that I don't particularly like, but his diaries are really full of detail and gossip and descriptions, and they're invaluable to anyone that studies the period.
You're not fond of him because because of that gossipy nature, he's kind of like a sly guy or something?
Oh no, it's not that. I don't mind gossips. It's because basically he's a bit of a lech, and he's also a wife beater. He punches his wife in the eye, and he tries it on with any woman that's left accidentally or unfortunately in his sphere. You know, you don't want to be a woman on your own and left with Samuel Pepys in the 17th century. You don't want that at all. So you kind of have to read his diaries and also remember that you're reading one man's impression of a time period, and not forget that, despite the fact that they are so rich and they're so full of evidence that's just, you just would not get anywhere else.
With the time period and some of your research too, and the woman side of things, you start one of your classes with the new, well, quotations, new discovery of witches. How did that begin? Like, how was there a new discovery of witches, and like, what time was this?
Oh, so there's a famous pamphlet called, The New Discovery of Witches, which came out in the late 16th, early 17th century. I don't remember the exact date now. But people were starting to be fascinated by witches, and it was linked in with James I of England, but he was also the sixth of Scotland, and he developed his interest while he was King of Scotland and before he was the King of England. And we did not have a case that's perhaps as notorious as, say, Salem, but there were witch trials and witch hunts in England. So we had the Pendle witch trials in the 1610s. And then during the civil wars, there was lots of witch trials, and a man called who named himself the Witchfinder General that lived in around Essex and East Anglia. So there were lots of trials there as well. But with my class, it's not necessarily about the witch trials. It's more about the archetype. It's about how women have been divided into lots of different categories and how that plays into, because my course looks at women who have killed, and it's how it plays into homicide rates and homicide convictions. And when different witchcraft acts came into play in the 16th century, you see a rise in the number of women that are convicted of homicide because witchcraft is seen as a weapon that they're using.
So somebody died in this building. Like, typically they find the killer or they don't find it, but now it's like, oh, Jessie lives two houses down. She had this robe on something, and like, she gets,
yeah,
she's guilty.
Yeah, exactly that. We saw her talking to a cow in a field 3 weeks ago. That must mean that she's responsible for the death of a woman's baby in childbirth. So I think that's a crucial thing to remember, that witchcraft itself was seen as a weapon in the same way that, say, a knife would be seen as a weapon, or a musket, or hands. So
yeah,
that's where you see the figures go up. And it's interesting because it's very gendered.
How did that fit into, I forget the other person's name, but you said the guy who one of his war brothers died, and then he was waiting for the afterlife thing, and then he became atheist. So did that movement sort of fight the witch movement, or like, was there?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's probably a bit too clear cut. I think the 17th century was definitely a time of transition. It's definitely a time when there were lots of different ideas being floated about, and people were thinking about lots of different things and questioning established religion, for example, questioning whether witchcraft and magic were real things to be feared, or whether they were just superstitions and, you know, fraudulent people were doing strange things. And it's after the 17th century that you see this witchcraft act is revoked, and it's replaced by something that sounds similar, but it's actually the complete opposite. It's basically saying that anyone that professes to be using magic and witchcraft can be convicted, but because it's fraud, it's not real. So, yeah. So you do see that transition, and there are multiple ideas going on with different people, depending on what they've read, what kind of level in society they're in, who their circle of friends are, what tribe they subscribe to. Yeah,
so, the tribalism.
Yeah.
How did this start, though? Like, where was the beginning? What caused the first people to have this new discovery of witches?
I don't think we can say that there's a beginning, because there's lots of influences coming in. I guess we can go all the way back to the late medieval period, when people are writing books about magic and how that links in with Satan and the devil, and particularly how women could be susceptible to being influenced by the devil and having... I don't know how old the listeners are to this podcast, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are lots of gross descriptions, basically, about how the devil would work its way into the female, how it would influence females and women. That there are tracts that are being printed. Obviously, the birth of the printing press is integral in spreading these ideas and notions. Different countries in Europe have different levels of interest in witchcraft and different statistics in terms of the ratio of male to female witchcraft deaths. We also have, as I mentioned, James VI of Scotland, who's married to a Danish wife, and in Denmark they are really interested in witchcraft trials. And when his wife is supposed to be transported over to Scotland, there's terrible weather, which prevents her coming, and it's rumoured that this is down to witches that have cursed the weather. So he goes out to collect it himself, and it's after that that he writes a tract called Demonology, which is an intellectualised study of what witchcraft means and where to look for it and necromancy. So people are reading these things because they're being written by high profile figures. And they are then looking around their own society and thinking, oh, well, so-and-so, that lady that's older and acts a bit odd. Well, I wonder why that is. Maybe she's a witch. Maybe she's practicing witchcraft. And the stories, as you mentioned, so-and-so doing one random odd thing and they must be responsible for another person's death. So that's kind of how it spread. There's the big story, the big history of it across Europe, but then there's the individual smaller histories of local places and pre-existing feuds between families, and witchcraft is a useful way to escalate those feuds or end somebody's influence, I guess.
Was there like a witch 101 where if somebody's a witch, their pointer finger has an extra hair on it, or like something like, oh, these steps mark a witch?
They would definitely look out for marks. They would definitely, if somebody was accused, they'd look for marks. What they would also, the specific marks that they'd look for, and this is what I wasn't going to say before, but I'll just say it and you can cut it if it's not appropriate. But what they would look for would be teats, where the devil was supposed to suckle on the woman, and they would look for them in the body, on the body of the woman. And they would look in very private areas to find these things, and then that would be the kind of aha moment for the justices. They would say, well, she's obviously got this mark, so she has been communing with the devil, and that means that the accusation must be correct. They would also look for familiars, and by familiars I mean like animals that would be associated with them, and they'd see them talking to them. We always associate a black cat with witchcraft or evil, and that's kind of goes hand in hand with this idea of familiars as well.
Was it more fiction at the time, or did that overlap with vampires?
Vampires don't come into British discourse until the 18th century. And that's when people are traveling to the east of Europe a little bit more. And they're exoticizing the east of Europe, and they're picking up on traditions and rumors and myths and legends about people that have come back from the dead. And they've come back... and they've drank other people's blood. But the idea of the vampire that we have nowadays, a kind of dashing, pale, male, clingy hero type, that doesn't really emerge until the 19th century. And that is very much influenced by the writer Lord Byron. The vampire is very much modelled on him. The earliest vampire novel is basically based on Lord Byron, and that's the kind of iteration of the vampire that we've seen ever since in most of the films. I mean, there are exceptions. Nosferatu isn't a Lord Byron figure, but most of them seem to follow that kind of type, a kind of brooding anti-hero. But we don't have that in the 17th century.
Were they also, I think I remember hearing something like, I want to say it was based off a guy who, he was like a, you ever see How I Met Your Mother?
No, I haven't. It's on my to watch list, but tell me anyway.
You got to watch it. It's like absolute one of my favorites. Ending could have been a little bit better. There's an alternative. Yeah, right. Like the Game of Thrones kind of thing.
Oh, God, don't. I'm still traumatized.
Yeah. So in How I Met Your Mother, there's this character. His name's Barney Stinson. And one of his things is he hooks up with a woman every night with new costumes, or he like plays tricks to just take them home and, you know, take them home to the bedroom. So what I was going to ask too is the vampires, was it based off of like some person in particular? Because I thought I remember hearing it as a analogy of like some guys sort of like taking young woman's innocence, stuff like that.
There's lots of layers to the vampire myth. There's as I say, that people were interested in Eastern European myths and legends, but then when it came to Bram Stoker, who wrote the definitive vampire novel, Dracula, in the late 19th century, we are starting to see these influences of Vlad the Impaler, the figure from the medieval period who was a warlord, I guess. I don't know too much about his actual real history, but I just know how he influenced Bram Stoker. But then you have people looking back to that, but then you also have people looking back to other figures like Elizabeth Bathory, who was around towards the end of the 16th century, early 17th century. She was a kind of near contemporary of Elizabeth I. And she was put on trial. No, she wasn't put on trial, actually. She was investigated in 1603, I think, for the murder of around 300 women and young children, because the rumour was that she'd been killing them for cruelty then. But the rumour developed in the 18th century, and we started to get this vampire myth entering public discourse, that she'd actually been killing them so that she could bathe in their blood and keep herself youthful. I think all of these things kind of combined to create a vampire mythology. I didn't realise we'd be talking about vampires, but I'm glad we are. It's that they're fun and interesting.
True. And that's kind of funny, because the bathing in the blood to stay young, that still goes on today with, there's conspiracy theories. I don't know if you've heard of them, but the top elites, it's a really brutal conspiracy theory. So I guess a little bit of a trigger warning or something. But the top elites, they'll take newborn babies and they'll like beat them up, like abuse them. And then they drink the blood, because the blood in the newborn baby, when it's fear stricken, release a chemical. And that chemical they drink, and it keeps them young.
Well, that sounds that sounds utterly ridiculous, but it also sounds like the kind of rumors people were making up about Elizabeth Bathory. It kind of confirms what people want to believe about the bad guys and whoever the bad guys seem to be. It's about othering people, I think. I very much doubt that happens. I imagine that there are kind of beauty treatments that people have that involve blood. I don't know. I'm not sure. You hear about people eating placentas, don't you? So.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
I've not done it, so I don't know. Maybe I need to.
I'd rather just go to Target and just get some skin cream.
Yeah, that exactly. On.
Moisturizer.
Just the regular stuff.
Yeah, keep it simple, easy. But bringing it back to the something I wanted to mention before was, you mentioned a little bit about it, but female killers, how were they perceived, and what were they actually like, the ones that did actually kill?
Yeah, there's a massive disconnect between the story of fictional female killers and female killers in popular imagination and the reality of women who've killed. What we're always attracted to in society is deviance. Anything that stands against the norm is interesting. So I need to caveat whatever I say now about female killers with the fact that statistically, men have killed far more women than the other way around. That's just a fact, roughly. And I'm just looking at British statistics here, so it might be slightly different in the US and in other places, but women have killed around 15 to 20% of people compared to men. And the story of women who kill changes. So we've spoken about the idea of the witch. Then when we move into the 18th century, we start to see the emergence of a kind of tragic heroine who kills because, and 18th and 19th centuries, they kill because they've been rejected or neglected by men. So they'll kill their own child, or they'll kill themselves, or they'll kill a lover because that lover has been cruel to them. So it's taking away agency from a woman. Then we start having laws that come into place, the insanity laws in England. And these insanity laws are really important when it comes to the convictions of women. Women are much more likely to be found not guilty by reason of insanity than men are. Because again, we're taking away that agency. We do not want to acknowledge the fact that women can kill, and they can, and they do. So that's interesting as well. And by the time we enter the 20th century, we're starting to see this evolution in fictional versions of the female killer, of the femme fatale. So figures like, I mean, she's not a killer, but figures like Gilda that have like drama and they can be deadly to men are emerging. I think LA Confidential does this so well, which is a kind of retro look, although it's got Kevin Spacey in it, so you might not want to watch it, but it's a kind of retro look at old Hollywood, but Kim Basinger plays the femme fatale character in this film. So we see that figure emerging, and I think more recently, in terms of women who kill, we're seeing many more, and this is very recently, action figures, like superheroes. We've had there have been precedents anyway. We've had it in Terminator and stuff, and with Sarah Connor and other action stars. But that's kind of the fictional story. The real story is much darker. So by a huge margin, the victims of women who have killed throughout history have tended to be their own children. Women have, we don't know the figure because it's a secret, it's a secretive crime, I guess, but infanticide is something that's gone hand in hand with the story of women who kill. We also see notorious cases of people that kind of defy the odds, like Christiana Edmonds in the 19th century. She was a female killer who poisoned people, but she poisoned people because she was doing that to deflect attention from another attempted poisoning that she'd made to somebody who was married to someone that she quite liked. And the press bent over backwards to try and bend the jury and the judge's decision and ensure that she got an insanity verdict, despite the fact that there was so much evidence that she'd planned it and she knew exactly what she was doing. So we get figures like that. In the 19th century, you get women that are running baby farms. Now, you have this in the US, not now, I hope not now, but it's where if you could not look after your child, if you did not have the means or the money to look after your child, you could just leave your child with a kind of matriarch figure, and they would, well, they were supposed to look after the child for you, but there were lots of women who were convicted of neglecting children so much that these children would die afterwards. So we have some quite high profile cases of that in the UK and also in the US. And actually the story featured, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV series The Alienist. It's like a historical drama. It's set in New York. It stars Dakota Fanning and who else does it star? Luke Evans. It's good. Okay. First season is better than the second one, but the second one deals with baby farming. There's lots of different cases and lots of different high profile figures associated with death when it comes to women. But there's also the archetypes that we find in literature as well, which really most of them just go back to the original Eve, original sin, a woman being the weakness of man. So, yes.
That makes me think of the one who planned that whole plot and then they wanted her to plead insanity. That makes me think of this movie I just saw the other day. I forgot what it's called, but this guy, he's like cheating on his wife. He's a bad guy. So then the woman fakes her own death, like him killing her. Then she gets away. She, what's it called? But yeah, she like runs away, but she has this whole plot going on to make it really look like he killed her. And then she kills
this... Gone Girl. Are you talking about Gone Girl?
That might be it. I think that is Gone Girl.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's it. Yep, that's the one. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a really interesting fictional character because she encompasses so many different archetypes when it comes to a female killer, the main one being the femme fatale. But yeah, that's a really interesting book. And there was a reason why that was such a huge success when it first came out. It was... Who wrote it? Is it Gillian Flynn? Probably wrong, but it's an unreliable unreliable narrator. The lead character is in the book and also in the film. But it's really interesting. If you want a male version of that, I'd really recommend the book Engleby by Sebastian Faulks. Again, it's an unreliable character that seems to be surrounded by death, and we don't quite know why. We don't quite know whether we should trust the narrator or not.
Yeah, I like those mysteries more. Like, I want them to make more movies and shows based around that, where you actually guessing who's guilty, who's not. Because Gone Girl, halfway in, I had no idea.
Did you not?
Nah, I didn't. I thought the guy was innocent because there's like one scene that I was like, all right, I think he is innocent because they wanted us to think that he did it. I'm like, when a movie makes you think one thing, it's kind of always the opposite.
Yeah. I like stories like that. There's one, a book that was adapted to a film recently. And I think it was called The Girl. It's such a cliche title. It's like The Girl something or other. The Girl in the Window or something. But anyway, the author of that has got quite a dodgy history. So if you watch the film, enjoy it for what it is, but then do a little Google of the author and have a little think on that.
All right, will do. And a question I have about the history part was, bring it back a little bit, the witchcraft and seeing women as witches and then the insanity cases, was that sort of a switch between, like, could somebody be a witch and plead insanity, or was insanity now the solution for witchcraft? Did they mingle at all?
No, they didn't mingle at all, actually. There was a whole century between the two. But both of them, I think, are ways to remove humanity, remove agency from someone. So either they're a witch and they're just, you know, pure evil or being seduced by the devil, or they're insane and they don't know what they're doing, so they can't possibly have committed a terrible crime. Both of those scenarios reject the idea that this person is sane and a human that can commit an awful act. I think that's kind of what I like to look at when I look at the history of women, and particularly the history of women who've killed, because I think it's a really interesting way for us to view the stories that we tell. Because quite often, I mean, obviously history has been very male-dominated for centuries, a very long time, but I worry that we might run the risk of, by countering that, by elevating women and creating heroes or great women, and missing the fact that everyone's actually flawed and there are darker aspects to women's history, just as there are with men's history. It's just history, isn't it? So that's why I like to look at these things.
Yeah, I feel like that's a big thing with Hollywood right now, where I never saw it, but She-Hulk got a lot of criticism because she was, like, too perfect in a way.
Oh, but really?
Yeah, that's what I heard. I never saw it. But then there's, like, this other movie where, like, this woman's flawed and, like, she has a wicked development. I forgot what it was. It was a great movie, but it was, like, the opposite side, where it shows, like, the more human side versus, like, being perfect, I guess, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because I think you just have to have the right writers writing the right stories, and it's hard. Because I think, you know, no one goes into something with a bad intention, I don't think. I think everyone does. If you're putting a creative project out there, you're going into it with good intentions. You want to make the best thing you possibly can. But, I mean, we're all human, and we can quite often fall into writing cliches and not necessarily fully humanizing characters. I say that as someone that doesn't write fiction and doesn't write for screen, so I can be very judgy.
No, I feel that. I get that. And with back to the history, one of the names I saw with your research was a woman named Ruth Ellis. What made her stand out? Why, like, what makes that a notable figure in history?
So Ruth Ellis was the last person in, because we don't have the death penalty in Britain. And so she was the last person to be hanged. No, she wasn't. Sorry. She was the last woman to be hanged. Ask anyone who the last person to be hanged was in Britain, and they won't be able to tell you. And in actual fact, I've forgotten the name of the person. There were two of them, though, two men. But she was this kind of peroxide blonde, again, a kind of femme fatale archetype that people were happy to believe had committed a crime of passion. She shot her lover and was found guilty to have done it, and then she was sentenced to death. I don't think any jury in modern Britain would have sentenced her. Well, they wouldn't have been able to give her the sentence that they had today, but they would have been a bit more, not necessarily compassionate, but understanding of the whole, they take a holistic view of the circumstances. And because of that, she became quite famous. Well, not quite, she became very famous because she had this slightly glamorous history. She'd been an extra in some films and things. People like to imagine that she'd, you know, been mingling in circles, like glamorous circles and high society. And yeah, it was just a really huge case. And the fact that this young woman, who seemed to have everything going for her, was, you know, thought to be pretty, you know, living this glamorous life, could fall so far and so hard and then be executed. It was quite shocking. And it wasn't long afterwards that the death penalty was removed from Britain.
It makes me think of the opposite, where, like, O.J. Simpson, like, the opposite, where he was very high up standings, but then he got off the hook when a lot of people think he did it. I might be one of those people. But, yeah, I got you. All right, I think I got
these high-profile cases are just interesting, aren't they, when you've got, I mean, the O.J. Simpson... I mean, I am no expert on this. I'm just a commentator, like somebody that's interested in it from abroad. But when you have somebody that's so huge in terms of celebrity in a trial of such magnitude, it's just enormous in terms of the mania and the interest that goes into it. And there's so many twists and turns in the trial as well. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, we just had that again with the Johnny Depp trial. I wonder what the next one's going to be.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, that's true. And also, I would argue, and I'm not taking any sides with that trial at all because it's just toxic to do so. But I would argue that it's been interesting to see the way that Amber Heard has been portrayed with regards to all of that when you keep in mind this longer history. And that's not to absolve anyone of any blame or, you know, guilt or anything. I'm not that person. But it is interesting.
I don't know much about a trial myself, but that's almost like that hive mind thing where, like, they got to pick a side. They got to pick the one people like, people don't like. And then you saw how, like, Johnny Depp became the favorable one. And then it's like, oh, we picked out who we like, even though they're both toxic and they have this gross history. So, oh, this is the good, that's the bad.
Yeah. We always have to divide, don't we?
Yeah. And I think I got two more questions for you before wrapping up the show. One is... what would you pick to be known about female murderers? Like, what would you like to clear up, or would you like the public to know about that history?
Well, firstly, that it exists. But also, I want people to realize that the way female killers have been depicted throughout time tells us an awful lot about the way society has shaped understanding of women in general. And by pinpointing high-profile cases of deviance, women not doing the things that are expected, fiction, the news, all different types of media have been able to create this idea of womanhood, and it does fall into archetypes. I think we're moving on from that now, but there's a long history of it, the witch, the femme fatale, the tragic woman, and... yeah.
Gotcha. How is the female killer perceived today? Like, what's the right now, how they're perceived?
That's a hard question. I don't know. How is a female killer perceived?
Even myself, I don't know.
How do you think? When I say female killer, who would you think of?
I really can't. Like, I can't.
You probably think of Eileen Wuornos or Wuornos. I'm not sure how you pronounce her surname. The one that was the subject of Charlize Theron's Monster, the film that won her the Oscar about 20 years ago now, maybe 15 years ago. They don't occur that often, particularly serial killers. I think we'd think of a femme fatale. I think we'd think of a movie killer. We'd think of someone, maybe someone that's like in a film like Bond, an assassin or something like that.
Yeah, actually, no. Earlier when I asked the question, that reminds me, I think of the CIA, because I remember I was talking to somebody, and they had a lot of women agents because they weren't perceived as killers or whatnot because of like what you mentioned. So they were great for like CIA agents. So that's what I thought of.
Yeah. Covert.
Yeah.
This has been The Way Podcast. If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.